You're listening to the oneofus.net podcast network.
You've listened to oneofus.net for years. Quality shows that have made you laugh and maybe even cry. But did you know they produce podcasts that you may not have even heard of? For just a few dollars a month, you have the opportunity to hear quality podcasts like The Breakfast Pub,
Clegane Bowl 2016, get hype, motherfuckers!
The Original Gentleman.
I see this as an avenue to you becoming a huge chick magnet.
Oh, yeah.
And the Watch a Movie With Us series.
By the way, anybody thinking that his makeup is a little bit heavy here does not remember the 80s.
Oh, she's thinking about banking babies right now.
Oh, it turned into a phallic symbol.
Become a subscriber to oneofus.net and choose your level of giving from red shirt, brown coat, Time Lord, and Jedi. And know that your donation will help bring quality oral entertainment to you for years to come. Thank you. And may Cthulhu devour your house last.
This is the Unnamed Interview Show. I'm Chris, as I always am, and with me is movie savant League.
Hey, Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's so good to finally get a chance to sit down with you and talk about stuff. I mean, my God, we've shared beers together for over a decade now.
Yeah, so it's probably rounding to two decades, honestly.
But... Oh, my God. I'm so old. It feels like the first Fantastic Fest was just, like, last weekend.
I know.
In so many ways. Now, you've said multiple times in various interviews online about how you got started doing the Alamo Drafthouse. Mm-hmm. But just a brief recap of, you know, where you came from, how you got started, what brought you to Austin?
Brief recap. Okay, so I was an engineer for Shell Oil. That's what I studied in college.
Mechanical engineer.
And actually, it was in my junior year of college I realized I had made a mistake, but I'd done all the hard work, so just finished it anyway. I just didn't really have a passion for it. I did love movies. I've always loved movies. I just never thought of it as a career. Mm-hmm. Didn't want to make movies. And then one day, while I was working at Shell, on my way to work, there was an abandoned movie theater that had a for lease sign on it. I'd always seen the theater, but the for lease sign was new that day, and it just sparked that light bulb. I couldn't stop thinking about it. I started talking with friends about it that weekend, about the idea of opening a theater. And literally...
Did they all think you were crazy?
Yeah. I mean, they thought I was a little crazy before anyway, but that's for different reasons. So about 7 or 8 days worth of thought, I went ahead and signed the lease. And I had no right to do it. I was 23 years old, had never done anything like that before, never didn't know anything about business. And thus... That theater was a total failure.
And that was in California?
It was in Bakersfield, California, where I was stationed for Shell.
Isn't that where the aliens came down in Mars Attacks? War of the Worlds?
Yeah, I think they did.
Maybe it's Bakersfield, New Jersey.
Okay, right. So, Bakersfield, I guess its claim to fame while I was there was the methamphetamine production capital of the United States. So it's since gone to Mexico. It's one of the crops that we've lost.
Sweet. So the theater got built really fast.
As a matter of fact, I may or may not have employed a few contractors that were totally willing to work for like 70 hours straight.
So it has its ups.
Yeah, sure. It has its very extreme ups and also then it has its downs. So, you know, that theater failed, but we learned how to do the business. We learned about business over the course of that 2 years.
And you met your wife, Carrie, during that process, right?
Well, I had met her. We went to college together. So we had been dating in college and continued to date. She got a job in San Francisco at a microbiology research firm. She was on this... I actually need to check in on this project. It was supposed to be a 25-year project where there were going to be... trying to synthesize human blood from yeast culture to make a like a pure blood supply.
Wow.
Artificially.
That would be a big deal.
Yeah. And so you can imagine her parents when she said, I'm quitting this to go serve popcorn.
We're a little dismayed.
Yeah. Her parents and my parents were more than dismayed. They were just, you know, disappointed, which is almost a worse word to hear from your parents.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure not so much these days.
They're fine. Yeah. They both live here now. They're very, they've come to grips with our popcorn serving and, they all love movies too. So it works. It was just a shocker after they had paid for our education.
So you reconsidered the place you were living and decided on Austin.
Yeah.
What brought you to Austin other than the other, you know, seemingly more obvious choices of like New York and LA and stuff?
Well, we had gone to school, both of us, in Houston, and I grew up in Texas. I have a lot of family here, and Austin was the place when we were in Houston that we would go up for the weekend because it was the cool city in Texas. So we looked all around. I stayed away from New York and LA just because of price. We didn't have the money for the real estate that those communities demanded. But we looked at four or five other cities, and Austin just had everything that we were looking for. Believe it or not, it was cheap at the time. Wasn't served by what we were trying to do. Had a great film community.
And this was what, around like 90?
96 is when we started looking.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that. I moved here in 92 for the same reasons. I was like, why is it so cheap to live here? No one knows yet. Don't tell anyone how great this is.
Somebody told.
Somebody did indeed tell. So you opened your first Alamo Draft House.
Yes.
Down in what at that point was a relatively bare warehouse district. Do you remember when the warehouse district used to have warehouses in it?
Yeah, they're dropping one by one, those new condo towers. You know, and to be fair, it was a pretty thin warehouse district to begin with. It wasn't like a large metropolitan city where a warehouse district means, you know, lots and lots and lots of old brick buildings.
Yeah, it was like two blocks.
We had difficulty getting real estate because we were young and our only experience was a pretty severely failed business. So I was actually our fifth choice of location.
Oh, wow.
We knew we wanted to be downtown and in an entertainment district. That was part of the problem in Bakersfield. We were in a pretty rough neighborhood and nobody wanted to come. So,
right.
So we tried to get into a cool town and a cool neighborhood and finally were convinced a property owner that they could give us the second floor space, which was virtually unusable by anybody else. And that's why we ended up where we ended up.
Not previously a theater, I imagine.
It had a very boring life as a property. It was a parking garage for most of its life. And then it was at record storage for Travis County.
So you didn't have any one of those cool stories like it was a brothel back in the 18th
century? No, nothing like that.
Wasn't haunted or anything?
We did leave some of the parking line stripes in the hallway. We left two of them.
I always wondered about that.
So that's like a little homage to what it's past glory.
So where do you go from, you've got the theater, you got it started, you've gotten your staff, now what? I mean, what did you do? Like, so how do we get people in here?
Well, we weren't very good at that, actually. So the opening day was a promotion we did with KLBJ Radio, local radio station. We let them choose the opening night double feature. Mm. That was packed. They did a lot of promotion for us. And then the day number two, we actually played a pretty bad Clint Eastwood movie called Absolute Power.
Yeah, that is not one of his better ones.
No, it's not. And so... three people showed up and we were like, oh God, we've done it again. We've totally failed. And we hadn't really done a lot of marketing. So we hustled up and we, you know, did it back then. It's really, I mean, I had an email address and we had a website, that I built myself.
When we all had to learn HTML.
Yeah. And it's
manually.
So it's preserved through the Wayback Machine and it is eyeball searing. I remember being so proud of it. It's like, this is perfect. It's amazing. And it's so bad.
I wonder if some of my early websites are still out there because I used to do that just as a hobby to build out of HTML. And they were awful. They're clunky and blocky.
But at the time, if it's hard to imagine, it's not that long ago.
Yeah.
Like the wonder of getting this information, even though if it was just like blue colored hot links, you know, but anyway, I am digressing. At a certain point, I think it was about 3 weeks in, And we were really panicking because we didn't have that much money to keep losing money every day because we had a staff now for the first time ever. Bakersfield, it was just me and Carrie. I would do projection and she would run the box office and I would come down and serve popcorn and jump back and forth.
Yeah.
But that's it. And we cleaned and it was a two-person show. Here we had a staff we had to pay. And then the Statesman actually wrote a really nice article about it. Anne Hornaday, who now writes for Washington Post, maybe.
Okay.
She wrote a nice piece and then the first Austin Powers came out. And so those two things dovetailed and it just exploded. People started coming and we were able to pay our bills and we continued to exist.
What made you go? Like cinema and draft house, cinema, full food. I mean, nobody else in Austin was doing that at this time. Mm-hmm. In fact, throughout most of the rest of the country, the only other place I even knew of that was doing it was in Maryland, I was from, where they would have cheap third run movie, like not safe to sit down without putting a towel down first cinema and draft houses. What made you go? It seems like a much bigger investment by its nature of saying, yeah, we're going to go all in and do restaurant, bar and movie theater.
It is a much bigger investment in every possible scope. Just building a kitchen and running a kitchen and having the point of sale system, everything. So we saw it. So the first one we saw was McMenamin's up in Portland.
Realize they were first. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, we heard about them while we were in Bakersfield. And then during our Bakersfield stint, Carrie and I got married. Mm. So we had lived together. We were together every second of the day, except when we were running errands, well over a year. We slept in the theater. We carved out this little room behind the screen just to save money. So it's about as much stress as you can put on a relationship.
Sure.
And we said, okay, we're good.
Must be love.
Yeah. So we got married in the middle of that, and our honeymoon was actually we drove a camper up to Portland to go spy on McMenamin's. It was a super romantic honeymoon, just to take inspiration. So we do things differently than they do, but they definitely inspired us. And we wanted something that would be a differentiator and, kind of make it an event to go to the cinema.
Yeah, it's hard to compete with, the Paramount as far as bringing back films that's all you get. It's
right.
Just a regular theater. So you had to add something new to it.
Sure.
So where was the point that you went from, okay, so we're a movie theater, cinema, and draft house too. Maybe we should start adding the type of events that ended up giving the Alamo Draft House really its character and its personality,
Those were things, a lot of those events that we did in the early years were carryovers from Bakersfield, honestly. And we were starting to do them right out of the gate. We just didn't do them with the frequency we do them now. We were doing silent film with live bands. We were doing some, we did a lot of midnight shows. We did, drink pairings and lots of fun stuff. But it was really very sporadic. We did it on the weekends, Fridays and Saturdays. And we didn't up our pace. I didn't hire additional people outside of myself to do it until we opened up our second theater.
Okay.
Because what happened there is we were showing second run movies at the original. And then when we opened up the Village, which had first run movies, we found out that we severely cannibalized ourselves. People wanted the experience, but they would rather see a new movie than a movie from 6 weeks ago, regardless of the price.
Sure.
So at that point, we brought on some additional help with programming, and we made the downtown theater to be much more eclectic and started building out different niche audiences for, documentaries and a lot of different types of independent film.
So was that the point where it started to go? You started to go, this is going to work.
I think we knew it was going to work with the first one. It became pretty popular and we were making money and we didn't have to work every single day. We brought on managers for the first time. Those were wonderful days. The first day we could say, hey, we're not at the theater. we're somewhere else. But then when we opened the Village, that set about the path to potentially expand. You start hiring really good people to run the company. You want to keep them, and you have to have a path for upward mobility, right? Or else the really good people want to do more, want to make more money, and want to start a family or whatever.
Sure.
So expansion offers that. But for me, you know, at a certain point along the way, I was opposed to expansion for a long time, and then I thought of these other ideas about how if you got bigger, then you could be a real champion for certain types of movies and make a difference. And
yes.
And that's become my focus for why we're expanding now.
Yeah, you're like, when I think of you now and what you do, I think of the guy who may be the most passionate guy about just the love of film of anyone I know. I mean, and I know a lot of film people, but you know, like, you're a guy, when you find a movie you love, and I don't even know where you find some of this stuff, like, you're going all over the world to find these tiny little films, and then going, this is the one! You'll come out on stage in a costume.
I love movies. It was really my only qualification for getting into this. God knows it wasn't my, you know, business experience. But I still do. You know, I'm busy. I've got a lot of things going on, and I've started a family, but I still make a lot of time to watch movies and explore and try to find cool new stuff.
So let me go back in the said way back machine. Mm-hmm. Do we both listen to Stuff You Should Know? Is that where that came from?
The Wayback Machine is actually a website that archives old websites.
I thought you were just using it colloquially.
But I do I do like that other use as well. But yeah, no, somebody turned me on to the Wayback Machine and pointed out this grotesque monstrosity that used to be drafthouse.com, and I hung my head in shame.
Is there a way to destroy this? So this love of film, I mean, nobody like comes by movie. Everybody knows, you know, it's like saying, oh, you like movies, I like movies, we'll be best friends. Everybody likes movies.
Yeah.
Right. So those of us where it's an obsession, where did that start? What do you remember about that moment where you're like, this is going to be a giant part of my life?
I don't know the exact point in time, but it was with two friends from high school. Mike Gassaway and Tony Godaway. Not that those names mean anything to anybody besides me. But we became buddies, and then we would kind of do sleepovers on the weekend at one of the three of our houses. And it was in the early 80s, and that's right when the mom-and-pop video stores came about, and we all had VCRs. And we also all realized that these mom-and-pop video stores did not follow the same MPAA regulations that the movie theaters did.
Decidedly not.
Even though it was so easy to get into whatever movie you wanted to see. I mean, who can't figure out the idea of buying a ticket for another movie and sneaking into whatever you want to see?
That's how I saw Alien in the theater.
So we would just go to the video store and we'd rent, you know, five or six movies, and we'd watch them all night long. For some reason, our parents allowed us to do this. I guess now I realize that we're home, we're nerds, we're safe.
We're not out
vandalizing or, you know, doing God knows what.
At worst, they have to make popcorn.
Yeah, which they didn't. That was up to us. So yeah, we would do that for a lot, you know, most weekends. Like, that was what we did. We just, for some reason, just systematically went through, you know, the whatever our video stores had to offer in terms of horror. You know, what I'm going to call the genre of, like, a boob-laden movie.
Yeah.
And then sci-fi. Yeah. So anything we could get our hands on. And then I went off to college, and that changed. I didn't really do that anymore, but there was, unlike the tiny little small coal mining town in Ohio where I grew up, I was in Houston, so there was an art house theater. So I found a different set of friends, and we'd regularly go to the art house theater, and I'd start exploring something entirely different.
So you said horror, sci-fi, exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
Was it these alternative genres that really sort of sparked the passion, or was it earlier when you saw, like, Jaws or The Godfather or something?
No, I mean, I have a very strong memory of, like, my early memories are very cliched, you know, like, I was a total Star Wars nut back when it came out, saw that, you know, in the theater, like, 6 or 7, 8 times. My dad took me to see Jaws when I was 7, and he's a bastard for doing that. Sorry, Dad, but that was a dumb move.
My parents wouldn't, because my dad saw it and he was scared to get in the bathroom.
But I don't think, I mean, I had those experiences, but those were just, you know, they didn't spark any obsession. It was the high school days that created the obsession.
Okay. So now, stepping forward again to when the Alamo first opened, did any of that original staff, are any of them still with you?
Daniel Osborne, who has now, he's done every job we have to offer. He oversees our, citywide kind of, facilities program, just keeping the facilities up to speed. He came on in like month 10.
Okay.
And there's a couple of servers at the Village that have been there since the beginning of the Village, since, you know, 2000.
Lifers.
And then Robert Reyes, who works in the head office, has been with us since back in that same time. Henry Maza, who, oversees large events for us now, came in like year two or three. So Andrew McKeithren in technology, like, these are a lot of the old school, you know, well over a decade folks for us.
Well, now it seems like you were saying, like, when you got managers, it was this huge relief. You're like, oh, thank God we don't have to be there all the time. And things have evolved to a point now. It seems like you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
You've kind of set up the company so there's a bunch of people you trust that you've worked with for a long time who are handling the day-to-day of all the stuff. Mm-hmm. So what is a day for Tim League like now?
Well, it's really random. So I can dive in and get really granular whenever I want to.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, I don't have to do this, but I want to do this. We worked with a director, Jesse Moss, who did The Overnighters, mm-hmm. who I love this film. His next film was a documentary about the strange bond between Hal Needham and Burt Reynolds. So he lives in San Francisco. So I'm going to fly out to San Francisco. We're going to show his new doc and do a mystery marathon of all on 35 of Hal Needham, Burt Reynolds classics. And then we're both going to get on a plane. We're going to hand carry those films to Austin. We're going to do the same show in Austin the next morning.
That's amazing.
So that's one weekend.
I love the Needham Reynolds connection for that.
I do too. It's such a great era.
That's one of my favorite things about the show Archer, is that those guys who make that so deeply love those guys' films that they reference it constantly.
Yeah, it's a special time. I was an engineer. There's a certain amount of the data of this business that I love. So on Mondays is usually I get a lot of reports and just to see how everything is going. There's certain metrics that we measure to make sure that the business is healthy, and it's just metrics based around staff happiness, guest happiness, and profitability. Mm-hmm. So if we manage those three, then we're good. So we look at those numbers all the time. I was just in Brooklyn, and we're less than a month away from opening there. So
and friends of mine who live there are super excited.
It's going to be great. This facility is looking really strong. So in that mode, I'm making final decisions because I'm funding this project. In terms of closing the construction cycle down, so getting back to kind of more engineering type stuff,
mm-hmm.
It's really all over the place. I mean, the things that keep the Alamo marching, everybody's got those. So I just try to stay at a high enough level where I can look at it. We just hired a new director of technology or head of technology. And I'm meeting a lot with him to talk about what are our next steps and our investments in terms of how can we use technology to make the overall experience better. So I'm diving into that a lot over the next couple months.
Sense around?
No. it's more about, we have a really crappy app experience right now, but it's beyond like what's next, like how are transactions being done and how can we... I don't know, how can we use tools and ideas that are happening in other industries to make it a better experience at Alamo?
See, it's interesting. I wanted to ask you about that anyway, about the, like, how much has your engineering background helped you here? And it's funny that you've kind of come full circle back around, and now to you, that's the most fun part in some ways.
Well, honestly, my engineering background has been absolutely critical the whole time. And you don't realize it, it's not like I'm utilizing the same tools I did to size pumps at Shell, but like what draws you to engineering and the engineering curriculum is built upon incisive problem solving, and like business is nothing but that. Like there's always things that come up, and you have to engineer your way around problems, and I think you have to love that sense of problem solving. And in an abstract way, that's what I've always loved to do. And you can take that mindset into crafting, you know, ridiculous, stupid ideas that you can execute at your venues, or how to, you know, value engineer construction solutions at the end of a multi-million dollar construction project. I mean, it's all breaking large problems down into incremental solvable problems. And that was my education, and I use it every day.
I could use some of that. you do all of this, but you're constantly discovering these new films. What's the process now? Where are you looking, you know, to find these movies? Do you have a team of people who are going out to other festivals and then sending back to you the recommendations, or are you personally like making trips to these festivals? I was actually surprised you weren't at Fantasia right now.
I was supposed to be at Fantasia. If you look in the industry book, I'm there. My photo's there. My bio's there. I'm getting emails from people saying, "Hey, can we meet?" And I was like, "Nope, we can't." My travel schedule just got a little crazy, and the Brooklyn construction got complicated. So I needed to focus on Brooklyn instead of being at Fantasia. But I go to maybe I go to maybe four or five festivals a year. I always go to Cannes. I try to go to Toronto. Those are the biggest bang for the buck festivals. I like a lot of the genre festivals in Europe. I try to get to I get to maybe one of those a year. And when I'm in that mode, it's sort of quasi vacation. I'll try to, you know, turn off the email and just, you know, get up, watch movies all day, have a nice meal, have some beers with friends, and do it all over again. That's my ideal vacation.
Mine too.
We do have a pretty good team now. The first guy and the most, frankly, the most important piece of this is Todd Brown from Twitch Film. He and I became friends year two, Fantastic Fest, and he was very helpful in year two in tracking down a lot of these genre films. And then he came on as a, you know, official capacity, like leading the programming team. And then that meant he has a bunch of guys. Like he has somebody in Hong Kong. He has somebody in Scandinavia. You know, he has somebody in that covers India.
That are just looking at all these markets, and if something really is popping, they are like, guys, red flag right here.
And we maintain this very elaborate master tracking sheet of every film from every country that might be of interest. It's a massive document. And there's a team of about eight of us that are constantly updating that document with status of what... It's all geared towards Fantastic Fest for the most part, and then also Drafthouse Films for potential acquisition. And then also as a third layer is things we might be interested in playing at the theater.
Right.
So that team helps inform the decisions of what the Drafthouse is going to potentially play.
And you have those tiers via the Drafthouse recommends films now, which I love the wall of just the posters of like the last 6 months of Drafthouse recommends stuff that you'll seem to reliably pick really fascinating things. I just watched The Invitation, finally got to see it, and it chilled me to the bone.
Isn't that a great film?
It's so good. you know where it's going the whole time, but you're every bone in your body is fighting against it.
Without spoiling it, there's still a path that it could be.
Yes.
You know, it's like there's a crossroads.
Yes.
It could be this way, it could be that way. It's definitely one of these two. And I think they ride that for a pretty healthy long time. It's tense.
Seriously creeped me out, and I'd be shocked if we don't see some of those actors popping up in more stuff soon.
Yeah, yeah.
As well as, of course, Midnight Special, which is just, I mean, it's Jeff Nichols. What are you going to do?
You're going to enjoy the film. That's what you're going to do. Yeah, he's great.
The guy's never made a bad movie. I can't wait for Loving.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, yeah, that's right around the corner, right?
It really is. Like a less than a month away, I think, yeah. I want to say. Definitely, like, you know, it's going to be, I would not be surprised if at Oscar time it comes down for some of the big awards between Loving and Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
Not the original one.
Yeah, I think that's probably out of consideration.
Probably at this point. They just don't nominate films about the Ku Klux Klan either the way they used to. But so you've got the recommended films. Then you have the actual draft house like line of home releases.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the process for when how things get to there? Do you personally select those films? Is it all – are you the final word?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm the final word. You know, Drafthouse Films has been a self-funded enterprise, so I'm writing the check, and not just the initial guarantee that you pay, you know, when you buy a film at festival, but then there's a budget for that film that you need to spend for advertising. So mm-hmm. If I'm going to write a check of that size, I need to love it. But also, I mean, that's the fun part of the job. I mean, I very clearly had this headspace. Like, if I get to a point where I'm running this business and I'm not watching movies, then, you know, it's like somebody put me out of my misery.
Might as well
like, retire. Like, yeah. So, I mean, I got into this because I wanted to watch cool movies and discover new movies. And, so I will hire more people to handle all the work that needs to be done so that I can afford myself time to do that piece.
That is the dream there. And as well as who knew you'd be hanging out with all the people who were making and starring in these films. I bet you never pictured it would come to that level.
No. I mean, it's hard to picture anything beyond, like, our headspace when we opened the first draft house. It's like, that was it. That's what we're going to do. We're going to do this. We love it, and we're going to retire from it. So it's just strange little things happen that push you in a different direction, and then lo and behold, I'm running a large business now.
To say the least. How many are there now?
Brooklyn will be 25.
Good Lord. Are there plans to expand drastically beyond there for over the next few years?
Yeah. I mean, not drastically, but we haven't taken on any, like, outside capital. We haven't, you know, I don't have any interest in losing control of the company at this point. So
you had an exploration with franchising that sounds like, from what little I know about it, it sounds like you weren't real happy with how it went.
Well, that's complicated. So there's a period where that's when I wasn't ready or couldn't conceive of expanding and I didn't want to do it, but we'd set the ball in motion. You know, that was a little stretch where there was definitely tension. I stepped back in, we crushed the company all back together, and I'm the CEO of everything. And I really like where we are right now. So, you know, I guess I matured in those 5 years and was able to conceive of it.
Do you set up in the various theaters that are opening up, like, a small apartment for yourself where you can stay in when you're coming to visit?
I have never done that.
It seems like it'd be a good idea.
Yeah. You know, it's possibly, but, you know, hotels are fine too.
Fair enough. Yeah, you don't get any room service right at the Alamo.
Okay, so. Yeah, correct.
Or you could, I guess, and you just say, hey, I need a waiter for this room.
The Kansas City Theater has plenty of real estate where we could do that, but there's a lovely hotel immediately across the street. So I think I'll stick with the hotel plan.
So you come up with all these big plans for, like, elaborate events, like you said, with, like, doing the thing with Hal Needham and Burt Reynolds, which, you know. Fucking Burt Reynolds, Jesus. Mm. And I want to see that documentary so bad. I missed it at South by Southwest. I was very upset about that. Has there ever been anything that was sort of like the pie in the sky plan where you were like, this is what oh my God, if we could just do this, and then you realized it was totally not ever going to happen?
Yeah, we pitched Universal this elaborate deck. You know, deck is just like a formal presentation of, like, okay, this is what we're going to do for the 100th anniversary of Universal. It's like, okay, well, if there's any time where they're going to spend some stupid money, I might be able to snatch some of it and do something crazy. So it was sort of exploding the idea of the Rolling Road Show, going all over the planet. My favorite on that was, that we would run a contest and we would fly, like a handful of people down to Antarctica to show John Carpenter's The Thing at the station.
At the actual station they filmed it?
They didn't film down there, okay, but there's
I knew they filmed in an actual cold climate. It wasn't a soundstage, or at least not all.
But there is a facility like the facility. Okay. I think they were in Greenland or something like that.
Right. Which is ironically ice, and Iceland is ironically green.
Yeah. but I gave them the price tag for this grand scheme, and they passed. So that's one where I couldn't afford to fund it myself. But yeah, that one got away.
That would have been kind of awesome, though. Just sitting there with your giant Russell Parka thing on.
Yeah. Which, of course, you'd be able to keep. They'd be modeled after the ones. Like, it was all sorts of elaborate details. We noodled on it for a while. Thought it was a total home run, but apparently not.
Was there anything else, even beyond the Rolling Roadshow type stuff? Like, things you were, conceiving of to do inside the theater? Like, for one thing, you have these karaoke rooms in mm-hmm. Austin. I don't know if you've done that anywhere else or not. The styled karaoke room?
There's some in Dallas.
Okay. I haven't been to the Dallas Theater.
Yeah.
But where it's each one has its own distinctive theme, and mm-hmm. I'll get back to that too. But was there anything else ooh, what if we built this onto it?
We've been, we're going to do some interesting stuff at the new Mueller Theater here in Austin. Yeah, so there might be something coming down the pike. We haven't really finalized those plans, but I want to do something special here at our next Austin theater.
I'm super excited because that's the one going to be closest to my house. Yeah. So have you ever thought about doing maybe a Tim League's Haunted House?
Ooh, yeah, that would be good. I haven't really in earnest, but I love the idea. I love a good haunted house.
Me too. Sorry, it was a little too much. It sounded a little throaty like Kathleen Turner there for a minute. It got all excited.
I will tease you because I can't say exactly what it is yet, but at this year's Fantastic Fest, there's going to be something along those lines.
My pulse race faster. I have to take my heart medicine.
Yes, we have a crew that's coming into town for about 5 weeks that's going to be setting up something special that has yet to be announced. This is the first tease of that. I'm rather excited about it.
Oh, I'm just counting down the days. Fantastic Fest is the best week out of the whole year for me. I look forward to it so much. And so does almost everyone else I know.
Me too.
That's
me too.
The week. Everybody comes together, our insular little theater, like a experience where we're the whole outside world just shuts off. And mm-hmm. we're we just live here now.
Yeah, it is fun. But Numathon's got that same type of vibe of just, people you don't see, but once or twice a year, and you see them at this setting, and it's it's been year after year after year. And even though you only see them for this brief little window, they're very close friends at this point.
Yeah, it's total Vin Diesel and Fast and the Furious mm-hmm. family. Completely. So is there anything you can tell us about the upcoming Fantastic Fest?
I don't think we've done any announcements at all.
Nope.
We're very, very close to making an announcement. So the theme and probably opening night film and a first batch of, there's a repertory theme this year. I like what we did last year with Turkish cinema. It's going to be mm-hmm. something along those lines with, poster display, food specials, and, a deep cut into, a particular, avenue of unexplored genre film.
That's as you do. Now, circling back to the karaoke rooms, who picked the designs? Because there's you've got Texas Chainsaw Massacre room, and you've got 80s video gaming room. Yeah. And my favorite is the Satanic Chapel by far.
Me too.
I love to bring people in there just to watch their eyeballs.
That was largely Zach Carlson who... used to work for me full time for a long, 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 long time. Now he's kind of a seasonal employee. He works at Fantastic Fest. He's part of that team. But he's gone on to, try to forge a career in filmmaking. So he's off working on the new Zellner Brothers movie right now.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I knew mm-hmm. he was working for the Austin Film Society and Other Worlds Festival as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I did not know he was making his own movies. I guess, why should I be surprised?
Yeah.
How about you? Are you ever going to consider making your own movies? I mean, I know you get on the production and distribution level.
Yeah.
But, every young film nerd, to some degree, has those fantasies of well... Yeah.
No.
No?
I've never really had the urge. I don't think I'm a good enough writer, mm-hmm. for one. And I it's something where you really need focus. I lead a very scattershot life, right? And so
you'd have to drop everything for like
yeah. I really months. Think if you're going to be a storyteller, you need to just dive in and do that. And you know, you can sustain yourself with food and drink and sleep, but it should be writing and crafting the story. And I don't think I'm good enough to do it. But you hinted at that idea of producing, it's not like I'm an active producer. My role is really through the network of Fantastic Fest is finding, you know, emerging talent. And if they have stories that are low budget that we think are either amazing or nobody else in their right mind would do it, like Greasy Strangler, then I'll step in. It's fun because we're building this network of theaters. So a movie like Greasy Strangler, when it comes out, you know, we're going to support that at all of our theaters. We're working on all sorts of promotion and that sort of thing. And, it's in service of a great filmmaking voice that I think is going to be somebody people will at some point realize who Jim Hosking is.
I have not gotten a chance to see Greasy Strangler yet, but people have been telling me I can't miss it.
Well, we may or may not be bringing that to Fantastic Fest to have a little greasy party.
Okay, fair enough. Is there ever been any complication, though, with that idea of, like, if you did decide to get into producing? I know there's always been a strict line drawn between being able to be that involved and being an exhibition or distribution arm.
It's tricky, right? I mean, it's there's all sorts of conflicts of interest. So I just do the best I can.
You've never had anyone sort of say, no, you can't do that?
No. I don't think there's any reason why you can't do it.
It's just looked askance at.
Well, I mean, the biggest problems with conflicts of interest in the past, where it becomes illegal, is where, you know, were I to be a bigger exhibitor and a producer as well, and if I were to only make that movie available to my theaters and not other theaters, then that's unfair trade practices. And so, but no, God, anybody in the world that would ever want to play the Greasy Strangler, please play it.
There's got to be someone else out there who realizes its brilliance.
Yeah.
So let me, on that same type of topic, sort of, there's this economic breakdown that's existed for a long time between the arms of production, distribution, exhibition. And it seems like the exhibition level's always gotten the short end of the stick on that. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that? Or do you feel like changes are necessary soon to that model? Especially with the way that now that the home market's taken so much away from the exhibition market.
I don't know if they've really necessarily gotten the short end of the stick. I mean, my perspective is that the producers are the real, like, insane lunatics in the world, especially in an independent space. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no guarantee you're throwing down, you know, $500,000, $1 million, $10 million speculatively.
Yeah.
You're having faith in this crew that they can do something, they can pull something off and make it beautiful and make it marketable. So they have all the risk, like the exhibitors. They get to say yes or no. They can curate, and they've made none of the investments. And then the distributors are the ones carrying the weight in terms of, again, the investment of the advertising. So if anything, I think the exhibitors have had an easy route of it, being able to cherry pick and rely on the distributors to pay for the awareness. And, you know, it's interesting because I happen to feel that when it wasn't just these three colossal giants that ruled exhibition, that there was a lot more active engagement in promotion with individual theaters, individual theater managers, you know, people putting up goofy displays and having excitement about the movies and building local excitement. And that doesn't exist so much.
Outside of the Alamo Draft House.
Well, it does exist outside of us. It just exists only in the really small players.
Yes.
Like the big companies, it's all centrally run. That's, to me, that's a bit of a problem, that it should be the requirement of the local theater to generate enthusiasm for the movies they're excited about.
Local organic sourcing of, yeah. of film watching.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm going to disagree with your position that exhibitors got the short end of the stick.
I don't know if it was necessarily my position so much as an argument I've heard, and I was curious to hear your take on.
I guess I disagree.
So let's get back to fun stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Tell me about some of the most fun events or things that have happened to you while doing this. Like the stuff that you're just like, if you had somebody with you and you were trying to impress them by telling them stories and stuff like that was like, you wouldn't believe how badass this was. What stories popped to mind?
You know, a lot of them personally are moments at Fantastic Fest. I had such a good time at Itch.io this past year. This kind of, I don't know, 30-piece satanic marching band.
That was fantastic.
Yeah, it's just a bananas experience. And I just remember, you know, it's super hot. Everybody's sweaty. It's just like this throbbing sea of people. And I'm just...
I was right in the middle of filming everything with my camera. Can you believe this?
Yeah. So at the moment, I'm in the middle of this fray, sweating like a pig, pretty drunk and just happy. And just, it's like, I was able to, at some point, it's like, this is happening. Like, this is a byproduct of what we've done. And, you know, things like that, the food fight from a couple of years ago, which is just stupid and silly and shouldn't exist.
Everybody has always wanted to be part of one of those giant food fights you only see in the movies. And that was it.
Yeah. the landlord was so mad. We cannot do it again at that facility. We'll have to go out into the middle of nowhere to do it. You know, little things like, you know, we've become friendly enough with Quentin Tarantino over the years that when The Hateful Eight comes out, he just randomly rolls into town and introduces shows. And that, so I particularly like things when they're unexpected and almost, spontaneous. And it's like, oh yeah, this just happened. But I'm like, what?
And like when Nimoy showed up to actually show the first Star Trek, J.J. Abrams Star Trek instead of Wrath of Khan.
That was a great moment.
That's pretty amazing.
And also, I think we're going to put a plaque out in the back because, you know, it's a surprise that Leonard Nimoy was coming that night and he was just sitting in his limo and he really had to take a leak. And so he hopped out of the limo and just peed behind the dumpster.
Oh, you totally have to put a plaque up there. That's amazing.
It's like, at this date, on this time, Leonard Nimoy urinated on this wall. And this wall will never be the same.
I love that you like little hidden things around the draft house like that, like Easter eggs that you're leaving around for people to discover. It's your own Pokemon Go.
Yeah. But actually, instead of virtually.
Yeah, exactly. That's, yeah, I will just tell you my favorite experience ever was, I think it was, what year was the first Fantastic Feud / karaoke? Was it like the second year or third?
Third year.
Third year. Okay. So we were all there in the smallest theater in there. Mm-hmm. It was mainly just a bunch of horror nerds and you and a couple of like, you know, filmmakers. And that thing went on until 6 in the morning.
Yep.
We were so blitzed. So messed up and had the greatest time. I rolled out of there and just fell asleep in my car at one point.
That was a really good night. I remember that night too. That was a special one. And that was, you know, spontaneous. Like, we didn't have that karaoke night planned. We just went over to Rock and Roll Rental and rented like a goofy, small karaoke system, and it totally worked.
I remember at one point you came in with just a wheelbarrow of Foster's, which I believe was sponsoring that year.
Yeah.
And we were all like, hooray! Just amazing. And there's always stuff like that. You never know what to expect every year. Yeah. And you like, the unexpected is where the real pleasure is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Other plans like that this year for Fantastic Fest that you can just like maybe give a one word hint to? It can be completely obscure.
Like
they've got to chase it down like a Kit Williams book puzzle.
Well, I know we're rethinking the karaoke experience this year. Ooh. I found that it's just kind of gotten, the karaoke night's gotten a little stale. So we're gonna amp that up a little bit.
Reboot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited for that. It seems like it just kind of turned into a regular karaoke experience.
That's exactly, yeah. So we got to stop that. When it becomes regular, then we've failed to do our job.
So tell me a little bit, what's your favorite movie? Do you know? Because a lot of people are like, oh, God, seriously? I mean, is there one that you just come back to over and over again, or that you feel informed so deeply your love of a lot of other stuff that you can't help but call it the best one?
I have a hard time with that question, even though I have gotten asked it quite a few times.
I assume.
I like Rick Linklater's approach to it. He generally doesn't answer it the same way ever, twice. And so people come back and, I thought your favorite movie was, it's like, yeah, that is my favorite movie. You're right.
It's kind of like having a best friend. You can have more than one.
So I go back to, there's like some different categories for me. I have a really soft spot for two particular silent films, for City Lights and The General.
Yeah. Just both so great.
And it's almost out of guilt because I think for when I was, even through college, even through like the first year of the theater, I was a little bit dismissive towards silent films. I think I'd seen a few, but you see them in a really bad way. You know, you just like a 80th generation, maybe the speed is all screwed up and it's just bad resolution.
You almost have to rediscover silent film after you've been through everything else.
But then you see a few, and I had the same experience when I watched, I flew out to Oakland to watch the 3-projector Napoleon, the 5-hour Napoleon. And with City Lights, The General, and Napoleon, you're like, oh my God, like, the language of cinema was so well defined in the 20s. And you know, everything that has come out of film comedic timing, you know, began with those two comedies that I mentioned. But they're both more than that. They're both like, you know, they're comedies, but have this rich drama to them. And so I go to those because I remember watching them properly the first time, both at the Draft House. Actually, The General was in Bakersfield. It was the first time I saw that properly. And just that feeling of like my mind being blown and just feeling like such an idiot for even in the back of my mind being dismissive towards a silent film.
Right.
So I go back to those a lot.
Yeah, I think Modern Times was the one that made me go, what? and then quickly followed up with The Gold Rush, which is also
Gold
really
Rush
good.
Is amazing, yeah.
So Chaplin or Keaton, if you could only keep one. Tough call. I mean, I might have thrown in Lloyd in there as well, but you know,
if it's the three, I'd immediately ditch Harold Lloyd, even though I like a lot of his films.
Sure. But he's definitely the, like, you know,
I think I'd go Keaton, which is maybe like a bold move. Cause they're both, you know, Chaplin wrote his music. He's this incredible auteur, you know, he helped found United Artists. But I like the practical stuntman aspect of Buster Keaton. I mean, Harold Lloyd did this as well, obviously, but the physical comedy of The General is so staggering and amazing. And I found him to be a more cinematic filmmaker. So I'd go with Buster Keaton.
I actually agree with you. I think you can't talk crap about Chaplin.
No, no. Try not to.
but like Keaton is just, I think it maybe has to do with the fact that I was a Jackie Chan fanatic when I was a teenager and Keaton is where you go to from that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's discover. Like, that's who, I mean, Jackie Chan attributes everything to, you know, his torture at the Chinese opera and Buster Keaton. That's what made him who he is.
What was the name of the movie he produced about that? Do you remember?
I remember. I never saw it.
I never did either. I always meant to, and now I can't find it. Yeah. I'm like, wait, damn it. Where's that film?
I remember when Jackie Chan was doing the, you know, talk show circuit and be on like Jay Leno, and Jay Leno says, "So I understand you were in the opera. Can you sing something for us?" And he's just like an awkward, "I don't know what to say to you." And then he would try to sing something. It's like, that's not exactly what he was doing.
By the way, I just watched the Criterion Touch of Zen. I don't know if you've seen that one or not. It's overlong to be sure, but very good. Sammo Hung is in it. He looks like a teenager. Probably was a teenager.
I don't know if I've seen Touch of Zen.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
All right.
It's kind of the first Wuxia film in a lot of ways. You know, it's definitely the biggest influence from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. No question. So now you started with horror and exploitation and all that. What's the one out of that field where you're like, that's my baby?
Who?
The one as a teenager that you were just telling all your friends about, like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
If I go back to teenage years...
I mean, it didn't necessarily have to be teenager, but well, you know what I mean.
Okay, so in Alamo years, like my favorite experience / discovery was when we sat down and watched Toys Are Not for Children prior to BNet. And none of us had seen this film, and we watched it and were just like utterly destroyed by it. And then showing it to the BNet audience and sort of torturing these poor souls with that movie. Like, it's a good one. That and Night Warning are two great discoveries. I guess there's more discoveries out of that. The Astrologer is another good one. Roar.
God, Roar was amazing.
So there's so many of these types of films that, Miami Connection, where like, I'm so proud that we have brought these into the modern dialogue. Like, it didn't exist until we found them and put them out.
Have you ever seen Closet Land by any chance?
No, I have not.
I keep bitching because it's like one of my and many other people's favorite movie from the 90s that's never gotten a DVD release or anything. Just VHS with Madeline Stowe and Alan Rickman in a bottle film. Freaking amazing.
Follow up with me if you don't mind, because we keep a list of movies like that to see if we can track them down.
Yeah, actually, when I first discovered it, I first moved here to Austin and I went to Pharmaco. You remember Pharmaco?
Sure, yeah.
Where you go in for 2 weeks and they feed you drugs and you get paid a lot of money. My roommate had a tattoo of Closet Land on his
arm. Wow.
And I was like, holy crap, that's a tiny little film. I can't believe you know about that. But from teenage years.
So one of the movies that we really loved, when we were gorging on movies was, the first Evil Dead. And then I have this really embarrassing story where strangely the 8-plex in the mall, showed Evil Dead 2 in the theater. And so my buddy Mike and I bought a ticket to whatever, Bambi or something, and then we walked into Evil Dead 2. And I remember watching it, and I didn't like it. And I was pissed off because I was like, this isn't what I wanted. I wanted a horror movie. I wanted a scary movie. And this is a funny movie. Yeah. And like, I don't get it. I'm pissed off. This is not what I wanted. And my buddy Mike was like, you're such an idiot. That movie was awesome. I was like, no, the first one's better. This is totally lame. And I don't know when I fully realized how stupid I was at whatever, age 14 or something like that, that I think when it eventually came out on home video and we watched it again and again, I was like, okay, I admit.
I
was wrong. You were right, and I'm sorry.
We all have those. I keep having them sometimes. My last big one was Fight Club. Mm-hmm. First time I saw it, I was like, yeah, I don't like this movie. And everyone was like, you're a moron. So my friend paid for me to go see it again, and I was like, okay, I get it.
I didn't like The Big Lebowski the first time I saw it.
A lot of people didn't.
And it's one of those movies now where I sometimes say that's my favorite movie.
Yeah.
Because under the reasoning in that whenever it's on, whenever I pass it, it's like comfort food. It's like, oh my God, I'm just going to sit down and watch a little Lebowski right now. I can watch it over and over and over and over and it doesn't get old to me.
Something about that. I agree. I often quote that as my favorite comedy because it's like, it's about the only comedy that if it's on, you pretty much have to stop and watch it.
I don't know how they did it, but they touched upon something. So there should be a scientific analysis of what qualities that movie possesses to make you feel that way.
Because on paper, it shouldn't work.
Yeah.
It's a mess.
Yeah.
But there's something about it that's just kind of perfect. All right. So to finish up here, I want to ask you a question that I'm not sure you're going to have an answer for or that you're even willing to say, but I feel it's important. What needs to change in cinema?
Well,
not to put you on the spot.
No. I'm just thinking about how I phrase it, you know, because it's really important as we grow to make sure we don't lose sight of what's good about what we've been trying to do. You know, I live in, you know, near constant fear that and certainly we get these comments all the time. It's like, oh, you guys have, you know, totally changed. It's not the way it used to be. You guys used to be awesome. Yeah. You know, you suck. You know, I read those and I take them to heart. And sometimes they're right. Like, sometimes we have, like, moved in a bad direction.
The great mac and cheese debacle.
Yeah, it's like all sorts of little things, right? You know, we pissed off a lot of people. I like to change things a lot, and that's, like, to a fault. And a lot of people don't like that either. But it's important that we always have this sense of giving a shit about what we're doing, like making, just understanding that our goal should be that it's a fantastic experience. Like, you come out of a movie and you're energized and you want to talk to all your friends about it, and all aspects of it, from, you know, bright picture, big sound, curating the right movies, being excited about movies, to, you know, enforcing our etiquette policy, all these things. Like, I want everybody to do that. So I want the big exhibitors to have those same goals and standards to, you know, I think there was a period of exhibition where we were allowed to be lazy as an entire industry. But now that there's a lot of compelling reasons to stay home, we have to make the experience of going out to the cinema worth it, as an option to not just stay home and, you know, watch HBO Go, which I do plenty of nights, you know.
Sure. We got to get our Game of Thrones in.
Yeah, I, what are my current addictions? Stranger Things.
It was so good.
Yeah,
man, it was almost like they looked inside our generation's brains and went, "Oh, we know how to get to you guys."
Yeah, that was a real joy. I don't have a lot of shows that I watch, but still, nonetheless, it's going to take up some of my entertainment time, and so it's not to be taken lightly. That I think cinema can be viable forever, but there is a strong force, and there's lots of people and lots of money working on things like Stranger Things. Mm. And for every 8 hours I dedicate to Stranger Things, I probably didn't go out quite as much that week. That's it. It's real basics. I've never been much for gimmicky stuff in terms of, well, that's totally a lie,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
But in terms of like the base of going to the cinema, like the core act of going to a movie.
You're not William Castle.
Oh, but I'd love to be. It's a fine line. I don't think the future of cinema is in like 4DX, for example. I'd like to go watch the Fast and the Furious movies in my motion seat, but any other movie, it's an annoyance.
Yeah.
I want just a dark room with big sound and bright picture and a great movie. And I don't think we have to reinvent anything. I just think we have to make sure every touch with the customer is perfect.
That church that level of the church of film remains sacrosanct.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you feel when that there was that one chain that was saying, "Oh, we're going to make it okay to text in theaters"?
I actually got in a little bit of an argument with the CEO of that company.
Oh, are you serious? That's funny.
Yeah. I think that's a dumb idea. That said, could there be some sort of, you know, very clearly delineated, segmented experience where you have a second screen experience? Yeah, I'm going to keep my mind open, but I don't want to see anything that like drifts into, I hate the idea that, you can actually engage with a movie and be engaging with your second screen. I mean, I think it's impossible. It's a horrible affront to the creator. I mean, I know if I'm just having a conversation with somebody and I, you know, I happen to like pull out my phone and check a text that beeps in my pocket.
Yeah.
I come back up and it's like, what did you say? Like, I'm sorry. I just screwed up because I have no idea what you just said. And that's what happens in the movie. You know, nobody can effectively multitask. You know, that when you're watching a movie, you should be absorbed and in the movie.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Tim League, thank you so much for doing this interview with me.
No problem.
Anything else you'd like to add for people to know or things to look forward to from the Alamo Draft House, which, by the way, should be the movie theater that you go to if there's one in your town?
Well, I say if you live anywhere near New York, you should come to the Brooklyn Theater. It opens hopefully before the end of August, God willing. One of the things that's really unique about that is this bar space that we've built in addition to the theater. We acquired a 1870s touring German wax museum collection.
Holy crap.
And so the bar is called the House of Wax. And so the whole thing is like a museum/bar.
Now I'm going to have to take a trip to New York to see that.
It's going to be very unique. And hopefully a really nice place to chat about and debate the movie you just saw.
Indeed. And then the Mueller one coming up here. When is that opening in Austin?
I think right now on paper it looks to be January, February.
Can't wait.
Yeah. Be here before you know it.
Thanks so much, Tim.
All right. Thank you.